Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And today we're bringing a program to you that we actually had hoped we would be able to run for St. Patrick's Day, since it's very Irish, but that didn't happen. It's still a very important issue. We thought we would devote a program to Ballymaloe.
Yeah, Ballymaloe. It's mostly one person, so.
Well, no, yeah, I mean, that's what we're going to do.
If you're really good, you get your own program on the menu.
Well, it was really stimulated by the release by Dorina Allen of 30 years of Ballymaloe, and it's a fabulous place. It's a fabulous farm, world-class cooking school.
Yeah.
And Dorina is the principal there principal not like in her office in the elementary school. She is the one who founded it and carries it through. And she is wonderful to talk to. So while we had her doing this new book, we thought, why don't we rerun the interviews we've done before with her, one with the advent of an earlier book, second, with her actually at Ballymaloe itself, where we visited and had a delightful, delightful time. And also with her mother-in-law, Myrtle, who just turned 90, but you can hear about that in the interview. And we stayed at Ballymaloe House. So, all of those will give you a lot of information. And I want to say that it's also a lot of things coming up, special events at Ballymaloe. So go to the website to find out about those.
Yeah, let's put it right up front.
It's called cookingisfun.ie.
Right.
Yeah, and particularly check out LitFest, which looks to be major fun.
Okay, so here's Dorina Allen. Actually recorded the day before St. Patrick's Day.
Right.
So she's wishing her St. Patrick's Day in the interview, and we certainly hope you had one, and we certainly did ourselves. So here's Dorina in 2014, and we'll be back after a break with more of the story.
We are really great fans for a long, long time of the Ballymaloe Cooking School, the Ballymaloe House, Myrtle Allen and Dorina Allen, who we're going to be talking to now about her latest book called 30 Years at Ballymaloe. And it's a celebration of the world-renowned cooking school with over 100 new recipes. But the really interesting thing about it is, do you have an incredible photographic memory, or did you take notes? The details and the history of this were so startling. You remembered everything.
Well, not quite everything, but I was very fortunate that my PA, Rosalie, my PA of 26 years,
uh-huh,
came out of retirement, and she was one of those great people who didn't throw out very much. So we were lucky that we had, I never really thought about keeping archives or anything, because kind of one doesn't. But basically I was delighted that she'd kept so many things and photographs and reminders and notes. So we were able to use those as a resource to do the research for 30 years of Ballymaloe Cooking School. And then, of course, around me, you know, if you're doing something like this, lots of people, when they hear you're doing it, have different kinds of memories, and they throw in their tuppence halfpenny worth. So that's how it all came together. But, of course, it could have been like anything. It could have been six times as big, but one has to do a bit of nice, tight editing so that you don't lose your audience.
I like your two and a half.
Tuppence
halfpenny. I haven't heard that for ages.
I don't remember what it was.
But it gives you an idea how old I am when I remember that, in fact, there used to be farthings. In fact, my first real summer job between high school and going to university, I got paid 3 shillings and tuppence farthing an hour. running a milk bottle washing machine.
There are advantages to having long memory.
But I'm older than you are, so you won't remember farthings.
Well, here we have you with your red signature glasses.
And all the different reincarnations through the years make very amusing for a lot of people.
Yeah, well, I thought that was amusing. What did you think about it? You found it interesting? Or?
Well, you mean all those photographs inside the covers?
Oh, all the photographs, yes.
Yeah, well, it was, yes, and of course I was also fascinated, rather horrified, to look at how thin I was in the earlier years. I looked as though I needed a good square meal.
You do look a little thin.
And it was partly because I was, of course, working so hard in all of that to get the cooking school, you know, really going. And I suppose that was partly it. But one changes with, I'm more like the person that's photographed there in the purple dress at this stage with
right.
broad beans in my hand or runner beans in my hand. Yep.
Well, you know, I mean, you did have an advantage in point of time to see that actually there was progress being made in world recognition of Irish food, but it wasn't that pronounced. What ever made you think that you could turn on a project like this and make it successful?
Well, it wasn't necessarily particularly for that reason. It was just that, you know, everybody needs to earn their living in some way, and we were had been in horticulture, and then as when the whole cheap food policy really started to kick in, we were getting less and less for our beautiful produce, and it became uneconomic because our horticultural unit and our orchards and mushroom farm and all of that at that time really needed a huge investment injection of capital, which we didn't have, and it was obviously the prices were going to keep going down rather than up because the general public now, you know, there's a whole perception that cheap food is our right. So you can't produce top quality, nourishing, wholesome food and sell it for half nothing. So we had found a different way to earn our living. And so I was able to cook, and we had some farm buildings, and people at that stage were going to the Cordon Bleu in London or Paris for cooking classes. So I thought, well, surely I can start a little cooking school in Ireland. We're right in the middle of a farm. We grow a lot of our own produce. We've got wonderful fish, etc., that people will come to rather than going abroad. And I thought, well, it must be as good as anything anywhere in the world. And so that's how I started in 1983 in some converted farm buildings with a great produce that we were growing ourselves and a whole network of small producers, cheesemakers and fish smokers and so on that were already supplying Ballymaloe House, my mother-in-law, Myrtle Allen, and my father-in-law's restaurant and, as you would call it over here, country inn called Ballymaloe in East Cork. So we had a great network of artisan producers and suppliers who supplied them. So I thought, well, look, I've got the perfect ingredients to start a little cooking school, and, you know, maybe people will eventually come from abroad, which they did. Within 2 years, we had our first American student. But now, for quite a long time, students come from all over the world.
Well, when we were there, there was something on this 12-week program that you have, where you also have a residential component, I believe.
That's right.
Yeah, but there were, I think, 11 different countries represented.
11 nationalities, yes. Well, that's not unusual. We had 14 different nationalities on the last course. On the present course, there are 9 nationalities. So it's wonderful to have such a mixture of nationalities and ages. And literally, the 12-week program is now looked on as an investment. I mean, people literally are prepared to use redundancy money or to borrow money and to do it because they know it's going to equip them with the skills to earn their living from the cooking if they want to, or to travel with their skills and get a job, because, you know, how it can cook will travel, so you can go anywhere in the world. But we also, of course, as you may know, do lots of other short courses, days, weekends, weeks, and if people are in Ireland on holiday, they can look and see what's on and come in on an afternoon cooking class if they want to, or spend a day or a weekend with us. And we now, the last year actually, we introduced another thing. It's like a week at Ballymaloe Cookery School, so people see behind the scenes in the farm and the gardens as well. They can see our animals. They can learn how to sow seeds. They can learn how to make cheese and butter and yogurt. They can see how the farm and everything operates, as well as having cooking classes and visit some of the producers in the area. So that's been a huge success. People love to be able to really see how everything is done from scratch, and it's always been doing things from scratch is the way we are.
It hasn't been a
recent conversion on the road to Damascus. We realized, of course, that we were, you know, doing the original, what's now referred to as the farm to fork experience. It was one of the, you know, it was just the way we were, really. We were in the middle of a farm. We produced a lot of our own food. And as I said, we have an acre of greenhouses, so we use that like a protected garden. So we grew, I think, over 80 different crops, albeit some of it in small quantities, on the farm. And we have 7 Jersey cows, so we milk those every day. And then the students can literally separate the milk from the cream, make wonderful Jersey butter, so that they can learn all these things as well as learning how to cook. They really learn food is from the farm or from the greenhouses onto the table, and how the animals are produced, etc., We have some pigs of our own as well. We have chickens,
yes, the pigs, yeah.
That kind of thing. So it's a it's a total immersion in if people come for 12 weeks. And then they literally go into restaurant kitchens and all write about food or do television or whatever.
Well, it's an absolutely glorious place.
well, you're very kind to say that.
Oh,
yeah.
I mean, I just love wandering those gardens. You have so many different components. You're always moving on to the next more expansive project.
So, yes?
We mustn't forget that the nice part about this is that if listeners don't remember all the details we're talking about, they can and they should buy the book, because the book tells the real story and the book reveals some of the craziness behind this idea. And and you're
well, opening a world, what's now, I suppose you could say, a world cooking school in Ireland, of all places, where people thought we lived on corned beef and cabbage.
Exactly.
I suppose sounded like a bit of a daft idea, but
and
the other hand, I think at this stage the word is certainly out there now about the extraordinary renaissance in Irish food and produce and all of that. So and people, I think, realize that you can come to Ireland now, not just for the food and for the, not just for the, sorry, for the friendly people and the landscape, but for the really wonderful food you can get everywhere.
Oh, we've been twice.
Did you find
again.
That? Yeah.
Yeah, we returned twice since we interviewed you at Ballymaloe. We did Western, and then this last trip, we went all the way north
to Inishowen Peninsula, and we visited with a guy whose name escapes me now. Doherty.
Was it Donald Doherty?
Yes.
Isn't he wonderful?
He is absolutely fabulous. We questioned ourselves, you know, do we really need this 250-mile detour?
Oh, it was beautiful.
And a couple of chefs in Galway.
And here in Galway, the McAvoy boys and so on as well. You know, there's such a lot going on. It's so exciting.
Oh, there is.
And I think, in a way, partly in Ireland for years, we had a sort of an inferiority complex. We kind of thought that what you had in America or the UK or something must be miles better than what we have. But now, of course, so many people have grown so much more in confidence. We realize when people travel more and so on, you realize what we have at home. And we now realize that in Ireland, we are so blessed by nature and by the good Lord in the terms of we have, you know, rich, fertile soil. We have no difficulty with water. You know, we have, you know, miles and miles of wonderful coastline with really good fish and shellfish and seaweeds, of course, of all kinds.
Yes, I love that thing about the pudding you made with the seaweed. What was that?
Oh, carrageen moss pudding, exactly.
Oh,
yeah.
I can't even picture it.
It's so, so good, lovely and fluffy and light. And then we have the arts and food, you know, producing movement. This has been one of the most exciting things that's happened to farmhouse cheesemakers and so on in the last 25 or 30 years in Ireland. And then now there's a whole craft beer and craft cider thing going on, micro distilleries, you know, so it's, and we've got great Irish whiskey. And then, of course, we can grow grass like practically nowhere else in the world. So we have many of our very best products. Come from our grass, our beef and our lamb, and, of course, that wonderful Irish butter, which you can get over here now.
Oh, right.
Of course, you can get Kerrygold butter easily.
Yes.
And it's fantastic. It really, because the cows are grass-fed, it's just the way we are in Ireland. And so that's so many of our best products come from our grass. And so we've only kind of woken up a bit late to how favored we are by nature.
Oh.
And
well,
then, of course, the young chefs like you met actually
yes.
now have the skills and the confidence. So, boy, you can have a fun time when you come over to Ireland, that's for sure.
We had an absolute ball, and we met all these interesting people. And we were interviewing Trish Desen, who's Paris, about her book.
Yes.
And we told her we were en route to Ireland shortly after. And so she put us in touch with a lot of these very modern chefs. So we went around looking them up and getting interviews and talking about everything under the sun. And there's so much going on. It's very exciting.
Yeah, exactly. Also, it's on all different levels, yeah. And with slow food and with the farmers'
yes,
market.
Yes, you're active in the IACP, International Association of Culinary Professionals, also the slow food movement. And so you've brought in a lot of international content into the development of your school and your coursework. In your book, you actually have a couple of guest chef
Lots of guest chefs' contributions.
The fun thing, I was able to pick up the phone to my heroes, everybody from Marcella Hazan and Claudia Roden and Marta Jaffrey and Alice Waters and all of them, and invite them over to the school. And that's I think you may not have known about this, but more recently we're doing a literary fest.
We missed out on that. Nobody ever mentioned it to us, and I read about it in your book. Are you working on 2014? Because if so,
yes, we are. This was last year. We had the inaugural Ballymead Literary Festival of Food and Wine, and funnily, there have been food festivals and wine festivals, of course, all over the world.
Right.
But there never had been a food literary festival of food and wine. So that seemed like the logical thing if we were doing a literary festival at Ballymead to do that. And so we invited literally the top food people in the world, not the sort of young, brilliant celebrity chefs, and they're all marvelous, Jamie Oliver and all of those, but basically people like Marta Jaffrey, Claudia Roden, David Thompson, Stephanie Alexander, Alice Waters, etc., and people who not only are brilliant chefs and cooks, but also who have written in a scholarly way and with beautiful prose and so on. So, and then we had on the wine thing with Jancis Robinson and many other iconic winemakers as well. So last year we were hoping for about 2,500 to 3,000 people. We had over 8,000 people over the weekend. And that was so this year we're doing another one from the 16th to the 18th of May. People are literally coming in from all over the world. And, I mean, the New York Times, Herald Tribune, everything wrote it up last year, trended all weekend, and Twitter. So it was just amazing. And we had a huge fringe festival as well. So it's going to be this year we have Reni Redzepi from Noma coming. We have Maggie Beer. We have lovely Diana Kennedy coming from Mexico. She's also in her 90th year. And so and we have 42 speakers there. The Otto Lengi boys, of course, are coming. Maggie Beer, Simon Hopkins. You know Maggie, isn't she wonderful?
Yeah, she is.
But so people can find out by looking at Ballymaloe litfest.com. They can get all the whole big, www.litfest.ie. Sorry, this book.
Okay.
But so they can find out the whole list of speakers on that. But that's the most exciting thing we've done in the last couple of years now.
Because the next thing that's going to happen is Anne's going to ask me how we can figure out how to get there.
And we're going to do it.
She didn't do that yet.
Lovely Board Fáilte, our Irish Tourist Board, they do such good things too. Help people to come into Ireland. And there's also another, I don't know whether you know about this other project that we're doing in Ireland. Last year we did the gathering where we encouraged, people to come and visit their families and families to bring all their people home. And that was a great success. But then now we're doing the Wild Atlantic Way, which is said to be Ireland's first long-distance touring route stretching from all along the Atlantic coast in Donegal to West Cork. And then you'll have a taste of every place as you go along. I mean, really, really wonderful concept, that wild, rugged coast, west coast. So it's called the Wild Atlantic Way. So look out for that. You can get some information on, www.ireland.com on that one.
Yes, I always read about this wild coast. And our previous trips, we'd never seen it, but this last trip we saw it.
No, we saw some of it the second time because we went all the way down to Kerry, County Kerry.
What was that wonderful peninsula we went on?
Was it the Sheep's Head Peninsula? Or Roaring Water Bay, maybe? There's so many lovely peninsulas. On the Beara Peninsula, was it?
I'm not sure I can remember which one Anne's referring to.
I couldn't believe that it wasn't jammed with other tourists because it was so magnificent, and I've never read about it in any of the books.
Well, the Ring of Kerry is better known, but all those lovely West Cork peninsulas, and then there are all so many of the artists and producers are down in that area, and lovely farmers markets. You can meet Jaina Ferguson and Veronica Steele and Jaffa Gill, so many of those iconic cheesemakers, at the markets. It's so lovely.
Well, there's so much going on. I guess we'll have to move there. How do we catch it all? But, I should point out that in your book, that a lot of these people who were visiting lectures and whatnot, and also in your travels, you brought back other interests. So you have really interesting Mexican recipes, Thai.
Well, yes, it reflects what we're cooking at the moment. And, of course, we have influences from all over the world. So, and every guest chef who comes, of course, inspires us. But also, as you quite rightly said, I travel quite a lot and to eat and bring back recipes. So, and then we're so fortunate because of living on a farm in the middle of gardens, and with having greenhouses, we can grow everything from chilies and epazote to lime leaves. And in fact, we grew our first pomegranate this year.
Oh, no, really?
So that was fantastic fun. And also we have one of the lovely things we do in the summer is we have a long table dinner in the middle of the greenhouses where everything that we serve comes from the farm and gardens in the local area. 100 people sitting at a long table in the midst of the plants. It seems it's a great celebration of, you know, the work of the farmers and gardeners and our local producers. So that's a really fun thing to coincide with if you're coming over.
Well, there's so many reasons to come, Dorina. And as I said, we'd have to move there to catch them all. But for anybody wanting to get a taste of it and then undoubtedly figure out that they need to, if not move there, at least travel there and visit the school. I mean, it's just the most wonderful. What would we call it? It's not idyllic.
Well, it's
hard work.
A cooking school in the middle of an organic farm and garden, so you're immersed in the whole food thing. And we have one teacher with every 6 students. So basically, there's a very high student teacher ratio, and you can, or the other way around, teacher student ratio. So, and but you can have the best fun and trip to Ireland.
And what about your website? Is it?
The website is easy to remember, actually. It's www.cookingisfun.ie. And if people link into that, they can see what's being taught on any afternoon, so they can just come in for an afternoon or a short course or come and immerse themselves in the whole thing for a couple of weeks or a week. And we also, by the way, we've been doing more and more of these bespoke courses where a group of friends may be traveling together, 4 or 6 or 8 people would like to have something tailor-made for the group. So we've done quite a lot of that, and we can have a great fun time doing that, and it's a great success, and people have greatly, greatly enjoyed it.
Well, I'm glad you have a lot of natural energy, because otherwise I don't think you'd be able to keep up with your success at the school.
You're very nice.
So we're talking about a book that celebrates 30 years at Ballymaloe. We shouldn't also forget, she reminded us as we began, that 50-year anniversary of the Ballymaloe House, founded by your mother-in-law Myrtle and her husband
Ivan. Yeah,
50 years ago.
And that's also a Nin, actually, which I think a lot of people don't realise, that there's a sort of mother house, Ballymaloe House, which is a lovely country inn and with a restaurant as well, obviously.
Well, we stayed there. Yeah,
sure,
it was lovely.
You should go to the cooking school just to eat the food. Then that's working too hard, I guess.
Well, congratulations on all your success and this book, which is absolutely beautiful. The photography is just amazing, full color throughout, a real keeper of a book, Dorina.
Oh, well, thank you very much. We hope we'll see some of your listeners. Tell them to remind me of where they heard the interview and what prompted them to come to Ireland. And we'll make sure they have a fantastic, memorable time.
Don't be surprised if we call you real soon and say hey, do you still have room for us?
Well, that's so nice. Thank you.
All right.
Dorina, you're in New York City at the moment. We hope you have a pleasant stay in our country. And I'm sure you'll be delighted. Even more delighted when you're on the plane home back to Ballymaloe.
Thank you so much. There are some really good things to eat over here, too, for sure.
Oh,
wonderful.
Sure.
Thank you. Happy St. Patrick's Day.
Happy St. Patrick's Day to you.
Bye-bye, Dorina.
Bye.
And don't go away, because we'll be right back.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. We're going to start our little story, our little history, with our chat with Myrtle Allen, who is a doll. And she is the one who really goes back to the very beginning of all of this.
Yep. In fact, curiously enough, just to eliminate any confusion, because it is very confusing.
They're all daughter-in-laws.
Dorina is the daughter-in-law of Myrtle, who is the original Allen, I guess, with her husband. And there's a third generation, too, also another daughter-in-law, Rachel Allen, who in her own way has a huge reputation in Ireland, does a lot of television and works.
She's a television star.
And she works with Doreena at the cooking school. So there are three Allens, but they didn't change their last names. They simply assumed the last names of their husbands in all three cases. So here's Myrtle, who Doreena told us just turned 90. We interviewed her 3 years ago. And she was as bright as a bun, took us on a tour of the entire establishment, and we couldn't keep up with her. So here you are with the dynamic Myrtle Allen and the beginning of the Ballymaloe story.
Here we are at Ballymaloe House, and thrilled to be here and to be talking to the founder of this great, great new tradition of contemporary, modern, basic, good, whatever you want to call it, Irish cuisine. We're talking to the woman who is the founder of the whole movement towards modern Irish cuisine, but she's also referred to as the first Mrs. Allen. We're talking to Myrtle Allen, and welcome, please, to On the Menu Radio, Myrtle.
Thank you. Well, I have two more Mrs. Allens up my sleeve.
It's wonderful how you all ended up being great cooks.
Well, it's very funny. You can't say it's hereditary because it
You're
goes.
Not related.
None of us are amazing. The only thing that might point to some hereditary influence is that the Allen boys all like good food and they choose somebody and then prime them of what they want.
Well, the house we're staying in now is. It's a restaurant and it's a guest house. You even have a section where you can self-cater, I understand. Activities outside, beautiful estate, your own gardens. But this was actually a family home and it has an interesting history. Could you tell us how this all got started?
Well, if you go back to the very beginning, it was started as a Norman castle, 15th century, 16th or 15th century. I haven't been able to find a record of its being built.
But we have pieces of the walls in the halls I saw.
Yes, you can. There is a date on the wall, you may see it. Lord Mountjoy, the British, was he an admiral or a general? I'm not certain. He had won, more or less, the Battle of Kinsale. He came here for his first night to Ballymaloe. He stayed here, Mountjoy. And the people who lived here were, I suppose you call them Anglo-Normans.
Okay.
They probably had Irish blood, and they also had British blood and Norman blood in their veins.
So this was a long-standing family residence, and then at one point it came on the market, and for some reason you bought it. You and your husband bought this.
My husband wanted to do general farming. He was on quite a small farm, 5 or 6 acres, and he was into horticulture.
Okay.
And he wanted to do mixed farming. He came from a farm. His mother had a farm, and he wanted to farm himself, and he needed more land.
Well, he had plenty of land here, but then you also had the big house.
Yes, for better or worse.
Yes.
Yeah.
Now, did you say you divided it in two, or what?
We did, yes. It was far too big. At that time, we had only two little girls, very tiny, and it was far, far too big. So we did divide. It's a very easy house to divide because there are two stairs in it, and that's right. One of the points that you want to watch. And we put our farm manager into one part of the house because my husband wanted to make sure that his other business, that he could give it enough time.
And so what did you grow those early years?
Well, we always had cows, pigs. We had sheep for a bit. We had, for a little while, we had veal calves. We always had eggs for the house, hens and eggs for the house, still do. And in Shanigarry then, they grew tomatoes, cucumbers, apples, mushrooms. And
they also grew 11 acres of cauliflowers, you told us earlier.
No, that was here.
You grew 11 acres of cauliflowers.
Yeah, on 1 year, we grew 11 acres of cauliflower here. And it all ripened in the same week.
So you had to go scrambling for recipes.
Yes.
Now, you said that you were not a trained cook, but you trained yourself through reading cookery books.
Yes, I actually did a year in the School of Commerce in Cork that teaches cooking. So three days a week. I did. It was quite elementary, but I did it. And then I went and stayed with a friend who was a very good cook. And when I came home from her, I got married and came back from our honeymoon. And my husband gave me a lesson on how to scramble an egg first night home.
Well, now, how you were then asked to write a column from the perspective of a farmer's wife for this journal.
Yes, farming paper, the principal farming paper in Ireland.
The farming paper. And you found that easy because you shared the satisfactions but the problems and everything with your readers. So you had many multiple interests there.
Well, yes, because we were all doing the same thing, running a farm in Ireland. Mm-hmm. And some people would have gardens and some people wouldn't have vegetable gardens. But a lot of people would have carrots and various things here.
Well, how did it go from these, what I will say, humble beginnings, because compared to what it is now, it's literally an empire at this point. How did it go from that to where we are now?
Well, it went partly, to begin with, it was quite successful, which I wasn't sure about. And we got customers out from Cork and from the town of Middleton, which is quite close.
We just skipped a point, though, because at some point then you converted the dining room to a restaurant. So that's
I did that first day.
Oh, okay.
First day I did that.
All right.
Yeah.
And then let rooms, so people stayed here.
No.
Not
like that. No, to begin with, we had no bedrooms.
Okay.
And we got bedrooms because of the Irish licensing laws. And it was not too expensive to get a license to sell spirits and beers. If you either had, were selling drinks, pub, or a hotel. And so I went for a hotel because for a lot of children in the house, the last thing I wanted was to run a pub here.
Uh-huh.
So we went for that, and we had so many rooms in the house anyway because it's so big, we were easily able to do it. And then, of course, when you do that, it's a very mixed blessing because you have people that, for instance, we used to have people that came in the autumn for shooting, and they'd want their breakfast about 4 o'clock in the morning.
Oh, no.
Yes. So it makes it more difficult, and you have more house to yourself. I mean, in the early days, we could, it wasn't so busy, and we are still able to use our house for our own use, but we managed.
Well, you must have met some really interesting people.
Yes, one does, but I don't like to bother interesting people too much. You know, it's enough to be polite to them and make sure they're comfortable without trying to use them too much.
Right. But we still haven't answered this question. What caused it to be so successful and to generate another generation and then another generation?
Well, I think because we're different to a hotel, and we have, there's a country house atmosphere here, if you like.
Oh, yes.
And our staff are wonderfully good, I must say. I have to thank them for that. And we take children, we take families. We rarely have people that object to children. And I think it's more like coming to a home than going into a hotel, and I think that's why.
It is, but also the food is very good.
Well, I do the best I can with it.
Well, you grow almost everything on your
Yes,
property.
We use all our own or locally grown food.
Well, I guess we will get filled in also tomorrow. We're going to be interviewing Dorina, who's the second Mrs. Allen.
Yes.
And then there is another
Rachel.
One. Rachel is her daughter.
Third man, Mrs. Allen, yes.
Pardon? It's her
third Mrs. Allen. And I must tell you that Dorina and Rachel were the two best students I ever had.
Oh, you're
Girls used to come to me, I think not always girls, but often girls. And they used to want to learn from what we were doing. And they were outstanding, those two.
Well, and certainly it's a name recognized around the world, and has certainly put Irish cooking on the map.
Yes, I think it did, actually.
Well, it's been a delight to meet you, Myrtle. I wasn't sure we'd be able to catch up with you. But,
well, it's lovely
and we're
to
already,
have you.
And we're very comfortable here already, and we just arrived.
Good, great.
Thank you.
Right, not at all.
You actually have to be at the Ballymaloe Cooking School and watch what's going on to understand just what a brilliant and dynamic establishment
it is.
It's
a magical place, and yeah, and so is the Ballymaloe House, which is just wonderful. Yeah,
but we had the opportunity to spend most of the day with Darina and the other staff at the school, finding our way around, sampling the food that the students were preparing. It was all in all just a great time, and here's Darina explaining more detail about what goes on day to day at Ballymaloe Cooking School.
Darina Allen, do you ever slow down or stop? You're a perpetual motion machine.
Oh dear, sorry. Well, it's a bit busy around here. Lots of things going
certainly
on.
Certainly, and here happens to be the Ballymaloe Cooking School, which you founded when?
Oh, back in 1983.
1983. So it's been going for a while, but it's been also growing. And it's said that the school has really put Irish cooking on the map.
My goodness me. Well, I'm not sure who said that, but that's a wonderful compliment. And, you know, it's like everybody, it's like water dripping on a stone. The ripples go further and further out. So the school has been operating now for over 26 years. So you'd want to be making a bit of an impact. And actually, it's great fun because our babies, as we call them, are literally scattered all over the world. So when I travel, often if I go into a restaurant, suddenly somebody says, "Hi, teach," you know.
Oh,
lovely to see you. So that's very nice. And actually at the moment here, we have 13 different nationalities who've just started a 12-week, very intensive 12-week certificate course literally 2 days ago. And this course is aimed for people who want to earn their living from their cooking. So it's very intensive, and it really connects people with how food is produced as well. Because you see, we're very fortunate. The school here is right in the center of 100-acre organic farm. We're very close to the sea, so we get wonderful fish in from the boats of Ballycotton, and so we have lovely produce for the students to cook with.
Well, everything is either grown here, absolutely here, or is purchased locally.
That's right. We have a terrific network of small producers around us here. What we don't produce ourselves, and we have very extensive gardens. We also have an acre of greenhouses, so we can produce a lot of produce. What we don't grow or produce ourselves, we, as far as possible, try to source in locally. And so we have about 150 artisan food producers, farmers, fishermen, and so on and foragers and so on that we buy from on a regular basis. And then when they come and deliver their produce to the school, you know, for example, farmhouse cheese or cured meat or smoked fish or whatever. Or if Nora Hearn, who's coming today, she rears beautiful ducks and geese for us. So I bring them in and say, and introduce them to the students. And I say, this is the person who reared these beautiful ducks for you. And, you know, really handled them carefully, cooked them so they're absolutely delicious, and don't roast the hell out of them when you get them into the kitchen, because so much love and effort went into it. And actually, it's really nice to... It's very important if you're going to be a chef that you are really think about the quality of the produce, that you really make local networks so you can get really good produce, fresh, naturally produced. Local food in season is something wonderful to start off with, because then it's so easy to make food taste good.
Well, this has always been your mantra, and yet it's come full circle. Now it's the trendy thing to do.
Yes.
But you've been doing it for years.
Well, that's right. Well, in a way, it's the way we were and the way we are. Well,
that's what your mother-in-law Myrtle said.
Oh, really? Yes. It's and it seemed to us to be the most obvious thing in the world to do, to start off with good produce. Because if you start off with a beautiful fresh mackerel that's just been come in from the boats in Ballycotton, or a few fresh shrimps or something, you know, you need to do so little to make it taste delicious, and people go, wow, this is wonderful. And
did you know to do that when you were probably inundated by French guys?
I know, but you see, I come from a village north of here in County Leashan in the middle of Ireland, and I was brought up, we had a kitchen garden, we had a house cow, my mother also kept hens and reared them for the table and everything, so that was the kind of produce I was brought up with. And then later, you know, if you go to hotel school and so on, very often they tell you, well, it's much more convenient to use some of the processed foods or frozen foods or something, but it wasn't long before the penny dropped that it doesn't taste as good. And it's much, you have to put so much more effort into making something taste good if you start off with mass produced denatured food. You really have to be a magician, and that's where all the twiddles and bows and smarties on top come in, when chefs have to try and compensate for the fact that the flavour wasn't there in the first place. So it's so much easier if you can get good produce, and it makes sense in every level. Plus, you're putting the money back into your local community. community, and that's a really important thing too. And then it generates goodwill in your area. Plus, you know it's fresh and it's in season, and so it, you know, it ticks all the boxes, doesn't it?
Yes. Mm. And now the mainstay, the main offering, is the 12-week course, but you have a lot of other options. Why don't you run us through some of those?
Okay. Well, basically, this the 12-week course, as you mentioned, is aimed at people who want to earn their living from the cooking. And literally, what we do on the first day is introduce them to the gardeners and the farm manager. And then the first thing they do is to go down to the greenhouses. And we have, you see, we use our farm and our gardens and our greenhouses as an outdoor classroom, and the school as an indoor classroom. So all the time, we're connecting people, not just showing them how to cook and the techniques, but also how food is produced. And
even butchering.
Oh yes, of course. And cheese making and everything. You see, we've got three little Jersey cows, which we milk every morning. So the students can learn, if they want to, this is extracurricular, to milk a cow, but they all want to. And then with it, we separate the milk from the cream. The cream is made into butter, and then we do yogurt and cheese making. They love that. Anyway, also we do day courses, weekend courses, 2.5 day courses, weeks, and also, we do a whole series as well of not just cooking courses, but what we call forgotten skills courses.
Right, which is your book that we interviewed you about.
That's right. That's my last book, was called Forgotten Skills, and it was based on these courses that we do. So it could be everything, anything from how to cure a pig in a day. We have our own pigs here as well, old breed saddlebacks and Gloucester Old Spot, and how to make sausage and salamis, chorizo, how to cure a ham, how to make bacon, etc., etc. So, and how to beginner's guide to beekeeping, how to keep a few chickens in your garden.
Oh, wow.
How to build a smoker, smoke your own food, how to make buttered cheese and yogurt. And actually, these came about because people started to ask me about, ring me up and say, look, I've got a pheasant, how do I pluck it? I've got a rabbit, how do I skin it? And, you know, how do I make a bit of bacon again? I've just overwhipped cream, how do I turn it into butter? And it doesn't say so in any of your books. And I realized that I know how to do all those things, because of course now I'm 63 years of age. So this was part of my childhood. It was part of things that I learned as a child. And so several generations now have missed out on these sort of things as food has become more and more convenient. And really, there's a deep craving now to relearn these skills again. Because I think really a lot of people, since the economies in many of our countries has taken a downturn, people realize we've left ourselves incredibly vulnerable by not learning any life skills. I mean, a lot of people can't cook for toffee. They certainly can't, you know, sow a seed or anything. So we realize that we've left ourselves very helpless, really, that we need not only academic skills, but also ordinary, practical life skills for every day. And it's not just from the point of view of economics. It's also for the sheer thrill of growing something and then eating it yourself, or making something from scratch. It tastes better because you put more effort into it as well. Plus, of course, when you grow something, and we're very keen. Students here learn how to sow seeds and how to plant a plant into the ground, and it gives them a respect for food and the people who produce it. They look on it in a completely different way because they've put more effort into it. And I have to shock the students out of thinking the food is something that just comes wrapped in plastic off a supermarket shelf. And really, when they sow a seed themselves and wait for it to grow into something that's delicious, they can't wait to bring it into the kitchen. They want everybody to know that they grew it, and they handle it and respect it in a completely different way. And unless you have a respect for food and the ingredients and the people who produce it, you'll never cook. It's very important.
Now, who does the teaching besides you? Of course, you love to teach, I know.
Yes, well, we have, here we have students from all over the world. At the moment, there are 13 different nationalities here, and that's not unusual. So our little village becomes very cosmopolitan, which is lovely. But so we have one teacher with every 6 students. So it's
Which is an incredible ratio.
I think it may be the highest teacher-student ratio in the world, actually. I haven't heard of higher. And so myself and Rachel, my brother Rory,
Rachel is your daughter.
Rachel is my daughter-in-law.
She's the third Mrs. Allen.
That's right.
We have 3 Mrs. Allens, right?
Yes.
Not genetically related.
She's the daughter-in-law. And so she's fantastic. She's very famous in her own right, does wonderful television series and books, and her programs are shown in America as well. So she also teaches. Also, my brother Rory O'Connell, who started the school with me originally, he also teaches, and he's was head chef at Bamaloo and worked in Michelin starred restaurants and all the rest of it as well.
We
have lots and lots of other teachers too.
We had dinner at your brother. brother's restaurant in Dublin.
I mean, yes.
So many genetic...
Exactly. Well, you know, I'm the eldest of a typical Irish family in that generation, where I'm the eldest of 9 children. And those big families, wonderful. And many of us are involved with food. And actually, now into this generation, our 4 children and our 8 grandchildren live within 15 minutes of us here. And very many of the grandchildren of Myrtle's grandchildren are earning their living through food in some way. And it's, for us, that's a great joy, because what all of us want to do is to be able to, it's lovely to have our children around us and to earn a living on the lands that we love and stay the country.
Mm. Now, you also have visiting chefs.
Oh, yes, lots of visiting chefs. So we actually, just last week, we had Jonathan Jones from the Anchor and Hope Gastropub in London. Absolutely wonderful. They're very well known for a lot of their, he uses a lot of less expensive cuts of meat and cooks them in a delicious way. They do their own butchering as well, just as we do here. And they also do a lot of sharing dishes. For example, he might slow roast a shoulder of lamb or a roast duck or something. And that's brought to the table and people serve themselves like it in a family table. They have a lovely gratin of potato and a salad or something with it. So he was with us last week. That was fantastic. And then we also had a lovely Indian chef from Dublin, who was Chef of the Year in Ireland here last week as well, called Sunil Gai from the lovely Anara restaurant. So it can be Indian, Mexican, Thai, Irish, traditional, whatever.
Well, there's so much going on here. What's a good way for our listeners to be able to follow what's going on and perhaps come here? A website, you probably have all the activities.
We have a website, www.cookingisfun.ie for Ireland. But if they're in Ireland, they can come down. We have the afternoon demonstrations. Cookery demonstrations are open to the public every day from Monday to Friday, sometimes on Saturdays as well. They also, our lovely gardens here are open to the public too. And Saturday, actually, we also light the wood burning oven over at the at that side of the school, and we cook pizzas just for Philip, my son-in-law, cooks pizzas, just about 4 or 5 different pizzas, always different depending on what's in season in the garden or whether we have lovely homemade sausage from our own pigs or whatever. So that's got a bit of a cult following as well, and that's just for 4 hours on a Saturday.
There are also residential opportunities.
Yes, that's right. A lot of our students actually stay when they come here in converted farm buildings here in around the courtyard, and those are what you might call self-catering cottages.
Right.
They have their main lunch here at the school, and then they have breakfast and supper cottages. But there are lots of lovely restaurants in the area that people can, of course, visit. And then there's Ballymaloe House that people can stay in if they want a greater degree of luxury. The cottages are very comfortable, but quite simple. But needless to say, Ballymaloe House is more luxurious if people want a greater degree of luxury.
Well, I must say, Doreen Allen, you've created your own world here and invited the rest of the world to come visit.
Well, it's very nice. You can feel buried alive in the country. So it's lovely to have people beating a bath to our door from all over the world. And to a great extent, I think it's because the cooking school is in the middle of an organic farm, and we have so much of our own lovely produce for people to cook with.
And it's how many acres?
A 100-acre organic farm.
Amazing. Well, anyhow, I'm so pleased that you were able to find time to talk to us, because you don't have many idle moments.
Well, it's a great pleasure, and welcome to Ballymaloe.
And right after the break, we'll replay for you the very first interview we had with Doreen Allen, the first, as we started to really get to know Ballymaloe. But it was a cookbook with more than 700 recipes, and we had no idea what an adventure we were going to be embarking on with that, with this beginning.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Doreena Allen, are you really called the Julia Child of Ireland?
Well, no, isn't that a wonderful compliment? I have indeed been referred to as the Julia Child of Ireland, and having met Julia and been much encouraged and supported by her, it's a wonderful compliment. But I also quite like being called the Alice Waters of Ireland, too.
Oh, okay, because, I see Alice is
popped up with testimonials and whatnot.
Yeah, have
endorsements.
Have you ever been to Australia, Dorina?
Oh, indeed I have, absolutely, yes. Oh, yeah.
So did you meet Stephanie Alexander when you were there?
I did, and also lovely Maggie Bears.
Maggie Bears, yeah. We know them very well. We used to live in Australia.
Yeah, we used to go.
It's funny how there are so many women who have actually made a difference in food in that sort of way. We cook differently to men, but totally cool. Long live the difference.
I always describe Stephanie Alexander as a combination of Alice Waters and Julia Child.
That's right, yes.
Because
she had such an impact on the ways Australians eat, really.
You know, she said something really funny. I'll share this because we talked to her before we were doing the program, and now she seems to be sort of practically retired. She said, it's really nice. When we started our restaurant in Melbourne, she said it was so easy because there was nobody doing what we were doing.
Yes.
So everybody flocked to us.
Yes.
And she said it got to be much too difficult, and now it's much more profitable to write books now.
Yeah.
I don't know whether you're finding that or not.
Well, things are really changing, and all over the world there's a growing awareness. And so many young, passionate young chefs and cooks now really respecting ingredients and doing delicious, really creative things with them and really going out of their way to source really good quality produce. And that's all good news. I mean, there's a lot of the other, too, but there is this sort of counter-revolution, so to speak, taking place.
Now, let's back up. I'm going to be talking about this book, The Forgotten Skills of Cooking, The Time-Honored Ways Are the Best, that you wrote. I should, by way of introduction, also point out that you're probably the most fabulous personality, TV personality, in Ireland. And the thing that knocked my socks off was that you and your husband co-founded this Ballymaloe cookery school in 1983 in County Cork, Ireland, and it's world famous.
That's right. I mean, I know it's a bit of a stretch for a lot of Americans, particularly to imagine that there could be a cookery school that people come to from all over the world in Ireland, because still the challenge when I come over to America of people sort of imagining that we live on corned beef and cabbage all year round, and wonderful as it is, there's a lot going on. There's a whole renaissance of food and food culture in Ireland, and you know, you can eat so brilliantly.
And
when
the
you come
produce,
to
your ingredients are just, you talk about pristine waters for seafood. And now, there was an Irish woman who wrote for the Washington Post. Her name was Anne, and I can't remember her last name. And I talked to her early on, early 90s, and she was really the one who told me about this great renaissance in Ireland.
Yeah, not before time, mind you, but it's I suppose it's been really gathering momentum for the last, certainly maybe 20, 25 years now, and slowly at first, but then like the ripples of water gathers momentum, and now that we have a tremendous artisan food community, specialist food producers, and people like cheesemakers, people who cure meat, rare free-range chickens, ducks and geese, and all of that kind of thing, and of course farmers markets as well. I was very much involved in the revival of the farmers markets. We now have, I started the first one after I'd seen the San Francisco market years and years ago, about 14 or 15 years ago, and now I think there are about 160, 170 farmers markets in Ireland, so that's also really vibrant, and they're weekly, and of course we have a wonderful growing climate in Ireland, a long season, so we can have produce the whole year round, really. We just closed for about 2 weeks just after Christmas.
The photography is absolutely stunning in this book, and makes you want to book the next flight.
But as if you hadn't done enough, Dorina, founding this school and creating, you're now into almost your third generation of graduates from the school, I guess.
We started the cooking school on our farm. We have an organic farm, about 100 acres, very close to the sea in East Cork, in east of Cork City, out near Ballycotton. And we started the school on our farm in converted farm buildings in 1983. It was an alternative way of earning a living on the farm as horticulture had become more difficult. We decided that I loved cooking and that I would teach cooking and pass on my skills. So in the first we had about 8 or 9 students and then 11 and then 18. Now we take 56 students, and we have students literally from all over the world at the moment. I think there are 10 nationalities. So, and we do long courses, what you would call a vocational, we call them professional courses, 3 12-week courses a year. Then lots and lots of short courses, days, weekends, weeks, or if people are in Ireland, you know, they could come in for an afternoon to the cooking school to have a cooking class. And then we also do these forgotten skills courses, which this book was based on.
Explain what you mean by forgotten skills, of course.
Well, look, I'll tell you what, it's really, in a way, we've had a big wake-up call in Ireland, and indeed you have had it in this country as well. In the last couple of years, as you may know, Ireland was referred to for over 10 years as the Celtic Tiger. Extraordinary growth, economic growth and all of that, prosperity, unprecedented prosperity. And so we sort of, to a great extent, were on one great long party for 10 years. And during that time particularly, but even before that, many young people concentrated on a set of academic skills. We wanted to be lawyers or architects or doctors or dentists or also, you know, all those sort of careers. And there was a sort of general feeling that, you know, why would you bother to learn how to cook, you know, I mean, you could buy it, you know, you'd have the money, you'd buy it. And cooking and indeed learning how to grow things and keeping a few chickens in your garden, any, those sort of things were all looked down on as sort of secondary skills of lesser value. But in the last couple of years, things have changed utterly. Many people are in quite changed, different circumstances. They've either lost their jobs or they've had to take a cut in wages. And so suddenly people had a set of academic skills that really served them very well during the boom years and had them riding on the crest of a wave, enormously confident and so on. Suddenly, in changed circumstances, they find that the skills that they had are of no use to them. They have no survival skills. In fact, some of our children's friends said to me one day, I've got to come and learn how to cook and so on. I can scarcely make myself a cup of coffee. And this was a young boy, brilliantly successful hedge fund manager in Amsterdam, and he suddenly was traumatized by the fact that he couldn't do a thing for himself and no longer had the money, because he spent so much during those boom years, nobody thought it would ever end. And so now people are really understanding and appreciating the value of a degree of self-sufficiency. We realize that we mustn't hand over complete power over our... We must re-empower ourselves so that we can actually look after ourselves. And not only for economic reasons, because obviously if you can cook and if you can do lots of those things yourself, well, it costs less money, but also the sheer joy of cooking a meal from start to finish and sharing it with your family and your friends around the kitchen table, for the joy of growing something and waiting for it to be ready to eat it and all of that, or catching a fish or any of those things. People didn't realize that that was such, and that there was so much, that it enhances the experience so much more when you have input into something yourself. So people kept asking for these forgotten skills courses and then for a book to go with it. So it's been really well received. It's gone into its third printing and it's only in the shops since before Christmas. And just won last week in London, it won the kind of Oscars of Cookbook Award, the Andre Simon Award for the best cookbook of 2000.
I can just imagine that. What I can't figure out is how you found the time to write.
You know about everything. How to wash casings for sausages. I mean, I actually have done that, but my son never did.
And here in America, there's an absolutely incredible revival of interest in butchery and in making sausages and chorizo, salamis, cured meats, guanciale, all of that.
Our latest stars are not the chefs so much as the butchers now.
Absolutely.
That was a signal event caused you, I think, more than anything, to write this book. So why don't you tell us the butter story?
Oh, indeed, yes. Well, this was the sort of the thing that just got me started, really. Was I was in the cooking school in one of the kitchens, and suddenly I saw a sort of slightly flustered student making a dash for the hen's bucket in the corner. Now, we live, as I said, in the middle of an organic farm, so we also, of course, have hens, and the scraps from the morning's cooking are fed to the hens by the students, in fact, and come back as eggs a few days later. So it's all part of a sort of a holistic system. And suddenly I saw this student making a dash for the hen's bucket with something in a bowl. So I'm always interested to see what they're throwing into the hen's buckets, because I always keep saying, you know, your difference between profit and loss in a restaurant can easily be the waste if you're careless about waste.
Sure.
So anyway, I looked in the bowl and I could see that there was cream which had been over whipped and it was sort of beginning to turn into butter. And so I said, don't turn that out. You know, and I said, to her, what's wrong? And she said, well, I was whipping the cream and I was trying to get my lunch out at the same time and it's gone all funny. And I said, don't throw it out. You've made butter. That's the butter. She was like completely wide-eyed and said, are you serious? That butter. So anyway, I brought it back
and
a little bit more and made it into butter, called the other students around. I realized that most of the students in the room hadn't connected cream with butter. So they were completely fascinated and all of that. And so and then several wanted to make butter afterwards. But even if you may not in your busy life decide you want to make your own butter. But on the other hand, if you over whip cream, then you can make it into butter rather than throwing it out.
Right.
These are all interesting little skills that our parents and grandparents would have, of course, just taken for granted.
I thought the funniest aspect of it was that you were sort of implying that the student didn't know where butter came from, didn't know that butter was made with cream.
Well, she totally didn't. just hadn't connected. the fact that butter came from cream.
Really?
Even in Ireland, sadly, we are so unbelievably detached from the reality of how food is produced. Most people buy their food in supermarkets wrapped up in plastic or on little polystyrene trays or something. They never see an animal. They don't even see a garden very much. They don't dig potatoes. So basically all of these things are a mystery. I mean, I once had a student ask me what kind of, now this sounds like utterly amazing, and this is completely true, what kind of, with those little pasta granules called orzo, what kind of tree do they grow on? You just think this is such a joke, but basically she said they were cooking rice, and it looks fairly similar to rice. So how was that person who's completely detached from how things are produced? It wasn't such an amazing question when you think about it, but really there's a lot of that, and it's really shocking, and particularly in our country, to find youngsters who simply don't know how to peel an onion anymore. We must not let, I'm a grandmother now, and I'm really passionate about this whole subject of passing on the inherited wisdom and skills that we've had.
Niece was visiting from England, and we served roasted beets.
Yes.
And she had never, ever seen a whole roasted beet or a whole beet period.
She said, yes. She said, what's that? She said,
yeah,
she said,
See, there you are. I mean, it's not just young people, it's a lot of older people too. So there's a lot of work to be done. And you see, a lot depends on dinner, so to speak. Basically, I was brought up at a time when the unwritten message was, well, if you didn't put your energy into putting, and your money for that matter, into putting really good food that nourished the family onto the table, well, then you would give it to the doctor or the chemist or the pharmacist. And my mother was utterly convinced that our food should be our medicine, and that if she fed us well, that we would be able to have a better chance of resisting disease, we would have more energy, vitality.
And she was right.
She was totally right. No, and that was at a time before everybody had a medicine cabinet with enough stuff to run a field hospital in their houses. You didn't have all these pills and boxes and little jars of vitamin pills and mineral pills and all sorts of things. You just bought really good food, or you grew it, or you bought it from your neighbour. And then there's the other whole point about local food and also seasoning. I mean, when you buy your food from a supermarket, most people have absolutely no way of telling, or there's no hint as to what's in season, basically. And our bodies need the food that's in season at the time. There is no question about that. It's scientifically proven at this stage. And not only that, but nowadays people, particularly in cities, but even in the country, eat very little local food. Now, nowadays everything has to be proved scientifically, but I'm absolutely convinced of the importance of eating as much local food as possible, because it's well proven at this stage that if you have hay fever or whatever, and you can manage to get your hands on local honey, it cures it completely. And you see, and the growth in allergies is just phenomenal.
Oh, tell my grandchildren. I'm appalled.
I'm convinced, and this, you have to, everything has to be proved scientifically nowadays. If you talk about anecdotal evidence, it's sort of almost a joke. But I have no doubt that the growth in allergies is connected to the fact that people are eating food from all over the world now, very often with bacteria and enzymes and all sorts of things, both good and bad, that our systems in a particular different latitude or whatever have never been subjected to. So,
look at lactose. I mean, this is a perfect example of it, right?
Yes, there is that. Very few people nowadays can have access to raw milk or to milk from their area. Milk was the one thing that, if it was raw, had to be fresh and it came from your area.
Yeah.
So I battle a lot in Ireland about for the right of people to drink raw or unpasteurized milk if they want to. I mean, if you want to have pasteurized, homogenized milk, you can go into any shop or supermarket anywhere and get it. But those of us who feel very strongly about the importance of having unpasteurized milk, we were all reared on it, for our children and grandchildren and the calcium and all of that that's in it and all of the other enzymes, people have a right to have that too if they want it.
Now you have this
very
book.
Important, yeah.
You have this book.
Yeah, the book is sort of, it starts off, I may not be using the right word here, but the word that springs to mind is a manifesto. You start off with this manifesto that there are these lost skills that people must recapture. But then then you went much beyond that and said, and this is how you actually make food using this set of skills.
Yeah.
With 700 recipes. Now, how did you imagine that someone would use the book.
Well, exactly, as it's written, really, because what's happening now is that people are, if they want to make themselves a bit of bacon again, or if they want to make a bit of butter, if they want to learn how to pluck a pheasant or a fillet of fish, or you were talking earlier there about, you know, getting cooking periwinkles or whatever, they go to this book as a sort of reference book, and it's had an incredible response. Also, it's not just that, it seems to have kind of touched places with people where it's a sort of a nostalgic thing. So there are many, many people who remember a life at that time when they were children or whatever, and suddenly it makes them realize the importance of all of that, and they haven't, in some cases, they haven't even properly realized that it was lost, and the urgency about saving it.
So if we do it this way, let's suppose you were doing things the way that you think it ought to be done. So you would go today to the farmer's market and you would buy for the next 2 or 3 days whatever was the freshest looking stuff there.
Yeah.
And then you come back and look in the index of the book and say, this is what I got now, this is how Dorina says I can cook this.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that would be good. And also, I hope that it will make people really think about what's in season at the time and use that. And to realize that, there are two other elements of the book I think the first chapter is on foraging. And
I was going to mention, two things I'd like you to talk about.
Food in the wild, because a lot of that food, you can forage in cities too, basically a lot of that food has not been mucked around with, to increase the yields and all of that, and it has many, many vitamins, minerals, and trace elements that are certainly not in the very intensively produced food any longer.
But it's a lost art.
They're very, very valuable as an addition to our diet.
We interviewed a forager from the Pacific Northwest, mm-hmm. and he it's amazing what all he finds to forage. But when I explained to him my method of determining what was going into my salad from my backyard, he was totally appalled, because my method is to taste it and see if it tastes like a weed.
I know.
he said there's poison hemlock all over the place.
There are, but of course there are some poisonous things, but you have to be street savvy, and you can't just go and eat anything you see. But you want a good book with a lot of good illustrations and so on in it. But on the other hand, you'd be surprised how many plants really are edible, actually. Much more than aren't, if you know what I mean.
Uh-huh.
I was really interested in the foraging section of the book everybody thinks of foraged items going into a salad, but I'd never before thought of putting foraged greens into a soup. There's a picture of this fabulous dark green coloured soup.
This time of year, quite soon now, we'll be making nettle soup. We're making lots of watercress soup this time of year. We'll have Alexander's quite soon, and morel. So you can forage, well, in Ireland particularly, we have a terrific growing climate, a long growing climate, and we can forage pretty much the whole year round.
Yeah, and you have a whole section on growing your own, and another section on preserving.
That's the other thing. I mean, you were mentioning earlier that you have quite a short growth in the area that you're in there. Well, that's the other really important thing, is to be able to have the skills to preserve the food when it is in plentiful in the summer and so on, so that you have delicious things to eat during the winter. And also, that's all about thrifty housekeeping. The whole skill of thrifty housekeeping had almost disappeared. And my God, had we started, waste has become a way of life. When I was a child, you get a clip in the ear if you left anything on your plate at lunchtime or whatever. But now it's become completely acceptable to waste. And in Ireland, they say that 30% of all of the food that's bought, I don't know whether it's changed now in the last year or two since we're getting a bit more hard up, but 30% of all the food that was bought literally went in the bin, and most people don't have chicken. So what are we like? We were always brought up to think that that was unlucky and that we simply must not waste. So I think that's another skill that's forgotten, and that the skill of thrifty housekeeping, and it's underappreciated, and actually in many cases people simply don't know how to cook thriftily and to use up less expensive cuts of meat and all of that in a delicious way.
Right.
Well, but the message is coming through in pieces. I don't think we've seen a book that has so much of it in one place.
Thank you.
You are to be congratulated.
Thank you.
Not only of bringing back time-honored ways, but also of really putting a message through about how you can cook almost everything.
That's good.
I mean, is there anything you left out?
Well, I could have gone on and on.
You could have gone on and on.
It was a year late, and it was over twice the size it was commissioned by my poor, unfortunate publisher, Kyle Katie. So she said to me, if you don't get it in soon, you can keep it.
Oh, dear.
And so basically, I had to get it into her, but there really is lots and lots more that I could add to it, and I still have more things. So maybe if she does a revised edition in a couple of years' time, I can add some more things to it. But anyway, I hope you're going to come to Ireland, because there's so much going on in the whole food scene in Ireland, and many, many good restaurants and wonderful, wonderful producers that you can go and visit on the farms.
And what's a good time of the year?
Tourism thing starting. Pardon?
What would be a good time of the year to come?
Well, you know, it's good to come when the weather's you can depend on, or slightly, not that you can ever depend on the weather nowadays, but from any time from May onwards, May to, you know, October is really nice. And so that's the late spring and summer, and then going into the early autumn. That's a lovely, lovely time of the year. The countryside looks completely beautiful, and we have, as I said, wonderful produce.
And everything is very green.
Oh my goodness, we can grow grass like nowhere. Many of our best foods come from our grass, our dairy products. You know, I know you can, over here in America, you can get Irish butter. It comes over,
yes,
I think, under the Kerrygold brand. And it's really, I mean, Irish butter is wonderful because of our grass. And our beef, of course, and our lamb. Many of our best foods come from our grass. And then, of course, we have a lot of wonderful fish too.
Well, but
the whole food tourism thing is now beginning to take off now, and there's an organization called Good Food Ireland that links up. You can actually Google that, and I think it's goodfoodireland.ie or .com or something, and you can, you know, literally, if people are interested in food, can go around from one place to another. You can visit the butchers, the bakers, go to the restaurants that are serving local food, all that kind of thing. So that's a very good source of information too.
Well, look for us, because we're going to make this trip.
I wanted, before we sign off here, I wanted to get Doreena to volunteer that she would help us with that planning for this trip to Ireland.
Absolutely, I'd be delighted to. And for anybody else who's coming to Ireland, if they just get onto the discoverireland.com website as well, there's an enormous amount of information there. But I'm very happy to help you. And also, if any of your listeners are coming to Ireland, just to say to them that at the cooking school, which is in Shanagarry in East Cork, we have cookery classes almost every day. So people, if they're coming on a holiday to Ireland and don't necessarily want to do a longish course, they could just pop in for an afternoon. And the school is in the middle of a little organic farm, and we'll be there with a big wide welcome for them.
Sounds wonderful.
Yeah, let's just sign off for those listeners who are still with us. And if not, we'll just make them go to the end of the interview anyway. You have a website, no doubt.
We have a website, www.cookingisfun.ie.
Doreena, thank you so much. You've been an absolute breath of fresh air into our program, and we're delighted to talk to you.
Well, I look forward to welcoming you to Ballymaloe in Ireland.
Oh, thanks. I've been dreaming about it. Thanks, Doreena.
And happy St. Patrick's Day.
And you too.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye,
Dan. Bye.
And just noted an interesting coincidence that in fact, our very first interview with Doreena about her cookbook of 700 recipes was also done around St. Patrick's Day.
Right.
But it was St. Patrick's Day 3 years ago, not St. Patrick's Day just passed. Anyway, that's all we have for this week. We hope you enjoyed that program, and we know that if you go to Ballymaloe, you'll have a wonderful time, as we did.
And say that OTM on
Oh, of course, yeah, and you should certainly say that on the menu sent. And they'll be sure to take good care of you. They'll take good care of you anyway, because they're wonderfully hospitable and incredibly talented and really fascinating people. So we're glad we had the opportunity to share this with you. We hope you enjoyed it and that you'll join us again, same time, same place, next week.
Bye-bye.